5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Forget the pressure to overhaul your life. The new year doesn't need a new you. It needs you. Grounded, supported, and ready to grow. Grow Therapy helps you make meaningful change at your pace and on your time. Whether it's your first time in therapy or your 50th, Grow makes it easier to find a therapist who fits you, not the other way around. They connect you with thousands of independent, licensed therapists across the U.S., offering both virtual and in-person sessions, nights, and weekends. You can search by what matters, like insurance, specialty, identity, or availability to get started in as little as 2 days. And if something comes up, you can cancel up to 24 hours in advance at no cost. There are no subscriptions and no long-term commitments. You just pay per session. Grow helps you find therapy on your time. Whatever challenges you're facing, Grow Therapy is here to help. Grow accepts over 100 insurance plans, including Medicaid, in some states. Sessions average about $21 with insurance, and some pay as little as $0, depending on their plan. Visit growtherapy.com/get started today to get started. That's growtherapy.com/get started. growtherapy.com/get started. Availability and coverage vary by state and insurance plan.
I'm Hannah.
I'm Saruti.
And welcome to Red Handed. We wanted to tell you about a Russian cannibal couple this week. You might have heard about them. It's suspected that they might have eaten up to 30 people. So allegedly, these two stored human remains in their fridge. You can Google the images of them serving a human head on a plate. Initially, the first images you find are pixelated, but if you try hard enough, you can find them. I believe in you. The pair were caught out when construction workers found a mobile phone filled with similar images of human body parts being prepared like usual food and being eaten by the cannibal couple Natalia Bakshiva and Dmitry Bakshiv. But unfortunately, we couldn't find enough information on these two in English to be able to write a proper episode. All we could find was the same statement over and over again. It was genuinely like one article was released from Russia and every newspaper in Britain and America just regurgitated that information exactly.
It's because the Russians are so busy pretending like this didn't happen, though.
They don't have cannibals.
Yeah.
No serial killers, no cannibals. That's a capitalism problem.
Absolutely. They're like running a secret cannibal food blog. They're like taking pictures of everything that they're eating. It's so disgusting. Like, if it's real, which I suspect that it is real, it's all just like a head on a plate surrounded by like lettuce and onions and things like this. Like, they're trying to present it and taking pictures of it. The fact that there's only one article and very limited information, I feel like they're trying to put a bit of a censorship thing on it, not laying it out and just saying it didn't happen.
Oh, I agree. It would be much easier for us if they did actually have a cannibal food blog. I wonder if there's like a satirical cannibal food blog. There must be.
Let's start one if not.
Let's start one if there's not. We always do this.
All right, put it on the pile.
Let's take on even more work.
Just punch me in the face, honestly. I just can't stop.
I'll look into the cannibal food blog. But don't worry, because we might have not been able to find enough information in English to write an episode, but we have put our Russian consultant, Katia, on the case. And hopefully she will be able to dig up some information for us that's not made it to the Western press. So stay tuned.
You've said her name now.
I know.
She's going to get got by the Russians.
There's quite a lot of Russian Katias.
Don't say her surname.
I'm incapable of saying her surname, so that's fine. That's how I keep her safe, never learning how to pronounce her name properly.
Massive ignorance. That's how I keep you safe.
So we might not be able to bring you the Russian cannibal couple this week, maybe in the future, but we have actually managed to find a pretty similar case. So strap in and put down your sandwich, because this is definitely a no-eating episode. We didn't want to deprive you of a body bits in the fridge story, so here we are.
In Costa Mesa, Orange County, California, Jose Escoval was asleep in his apartment on the morning of the 1st of December 1991. Jose was awoken that morning by loud banging at his door. It was about 9 a.m., and for Jose, that was way too early to be up and about. So he peeked out of the window and saw a red Corvette outside his house that he didn't recognize. Whoever that car belonged to, Jose thought that he didn't know them, so he just ignored the banging, hoping that the red Corvette owner would give up and leave him alone. And eventually, the 9 a.m. door knocker did leave Jose alone, so he went about his day not giving it a second thought. But the door knocker returned in their red Corvette somewhere between 1 p.m. and 1:30 p.m., and they found Jose's door to be open. So they just walked right into his apartment, and when he saw them, Jose realized that he did know the door knocker with the red Corvette.
It was his ex-girlfriend, 23-year-old Omaima Nelson. And when your ex is banging on your door at 9 o'clock in the morning, nothing good is going to happen next.
Absolutely not.
Bad news.
That makes me feel quite unwell.
Yeah, me too.
Thought of that.
I don't think I can imagine a more nightmare situation, honestly.
Than your ex walking through your door.
Yeah, just walking straight into my house.
Unannounced. That might be the scariest thing we say in this entire episode.
Showing up at 9 o'clock in the morning when you haven't even got ready. You're in your pyjamas because you've been asleep.
God, no.
Yeah.
No, bad news.
And it was bad news, as Jose very quickly found out. Omaima was very clearly upset. She'd been crying and her arms and breasts displayed visible signs of injury. Jose and Omaima had only gone out together very briefly about a year before. Omaima was married now to a 56-year-old man called Bill Nelson, so Jose was really surprised to see her. He was even more surprised when she told him why she was there. The hysterical Omaima told Jose that Bill Nelson, her husband, had attacked her, tied her up, raped her, and she'd managed to escape, but in self-defense, she had hit her husband over the head with a lamp and stabbed him in the neck with a pair of scissors. Bill had died as a result of these injuries, and now Omaima needed Jose's help to get rid of the body. And she gets quite specific about her body disposal because she tells Jose that she needs his help to get rid of Bill's head, or at the very least, pull out Bill's teeth so that he couldn't be identified via his dental records. And that is the first indicator you will get in this case that Omaima knows what she is doing. She's already thinking about dental records after a self-defense, she says.
And also, she really knows what she's doing as well, in the sense of she turns up and she's like, that Jose guy. I know, when you're like scrolling back through your phone and you're like, who can I text when I'm feeling a little bit like I need to go out for a drink, or
oh, yeah,
I need to dispose of a body. It's like, can you help me get rid of Bill's body? By the look on your face, you don't seem totally into it. How about just his head?
Can I start you off with the head?
How about just his teeth? No. Teeth? Do I have a taker for some teeth?
How about just the wisdom teeth? He needed them done anyway. So she tries to bribe Jose to pull out her husband's teeth with two motorbikes that belonged to her late husband and $75,000 that she said she had in a safe. And she offered both of these things to Jose in return for his help.
And Jose, at this point, agreed to help his ex-girlfriend with her frantic body disposal plan. He told her to go and wait in her car while he fetched his truck. Again, she knew, man. She had an ex-boyfriend with a truck. It's what everyone needs.
I'll just go on a few Hinge dates with one guy just because he's got a truck, and then that counts as an ex, kind of.
But the thing is, Jose had no intention of pulling Bill Nelson's teeth out. Because once Omaima's back was turned, he ran off to the nearest payphone and called the police. When the police arrived, they managed to catch up with Omaima while she was waiting for Jose to arrive back with his truck, which obviously he never did. Police officer Frank Rudisill was one of the team who initially interviewed Omaima, and he said that she was cooperative and he noted her visible injuries. But when questioned, Omaima denied Jose's story that she had killed her husband. She told officers that her husband was not actually dead, but just away on a business trip in Florida, and she had no way of contacting him.
So weird. She's just like, he is alive, I promise, I just can't prove it.
I know. I mean, I guess, like,
the 90s? Is it just easier to not be able to get in touch with people?
I suppose so to a certain extent, but if he was on a business trip, she would have known the hotel he was staying in and that hotel would have had a phone.
This is true. So basically the problem is at this point, she's like, he's definitely alive. I definitely didn't kill him. He's in Florida, but I just can't prove to you that he's still alive. So as cooperative and relatively calm as Omima seemed, the police were not convinced by her story. And the Costa Mesa cops were not the only people to be suspicious of Omima Nelson.
Omima was born in Egypt in a small farming village. Her father was very violent and her parents divorced because of it when Omima was still quite young. Omima's mum took Omima away from her abusive father and they moved to Cairo, where they lived in the City of the Dead, which is also known as the Cairo Necropolis, because it holds about 1 million final resting places. I've seen pictures of it. It's houses full of people in between 20 headstones just outside, and there are kids just skipping between gravestones. The City of the Dead has been home to the deceased since the 7th century. It was built during the conquest of Egypt, but now it's a slum in which the dead and the living exist side by side. About 500,000 people live there today, and many more are still there, but obviously not living anymore. When Omima reached 18 in 1986, she met a Texan man who was in Egypt on business. He worked in oil. The two started a relationship, and as soon as her family found out, they insisted that Omima had to marry her mysterious oil man. Omima was very on board with this plan. She was no longer a virgin, so she was pretty sure that she wouldn't be able to ever marry a Muslim man. And besides, marrying her Texas man meant she had a ticket straight out of the necropolis and onto the freedom of America. But married bliss was short-lived. The Texan oil man divorced Omima before the year was out, so she was in a strange country, on her own, her English wasn't great yet, and she was still only a teenager.
And the thing is, you can't read anything about Omima Nelson without coming across how beautiful she was. It's like mentioned in every single article and every single documentary, anything you read about her, she's so beautiful.
And exotic, that's the other thing they say.
Oh, I literally hate it when people call me exotic. I think people say it like they think it's a compliment, and it's not derogatory. I find it embarrassing. Stop it. Stop saying that. And the thing is, Omima was. She was like a really attractive woman. She was beautiful. You know, she got a few modeling gigs in the States, apparently, alongside nannying and working in bars in her post-Texan oil man years. But the thing is, as attractive as she was and as beautiful as she was, none of the pictures that you see of Omima Nelson look like they're particularly professionally taken. So I don't think like her modeling career can have been a particularly lucrative or impressive one.
Yeah, it's weird. Like everything you read about her is like, oh, gorgeous, exotic model from Egypt, like blah, blah, blah. Like, and I get it. It's clickbait. I understand why they're doing it. But she doesn't even have a headshot that I could find. So what was she going into castings with? The pictures that you see in the documentaries is her in a bikini posing on a bed. So it's kind of like someone's gone, I've got a camera. Do you want to come to my flat?
I'm a photographer. I'm just totally not convinced that people who scout for models are just hanging out asking random people to be like, come to my house and let me take photos of you, which is very much looked like.
No, exactly, exactly that. If anyone says, I'm a model agent and they immediately say, please come to my house, say no.
Run
as fast as you can.
So if we assume that her modelling career hadn't particularly taken off, it seems that to supplement her income and to find somewhere to live, Omima picked up men in bars and tended to initiate pretty serious relationships with them very quickly. But the thing is that none of these relationships ever seemed to last, and Omima bounced from relationship to relationship for a few years. And she didn't stay totally out of trouble with the law during these years either. She was caught shoplifting numerous times, and this is such a bizarre part of this story, and I think it gives you a good level of insight into like her behavior.
I think so.
Because once in 1990, Omima was approached by two female security guards in the mall and asked to empty her bag. At this point, Omima flew into a seething rage, and Omima bit one of the security guards so hard on the breast that it almost totally came off.
Bit of a weird move, that, isn't it? Just bite your boob off. I don't think that would be my go-to.
I mean, weird's a word. I think the word I'd use is absolutely horrifying. Like, fucking hell. It hurts if you just accidentally, like, bang into something, let alone if someone tries to bite it off. And the other guard didn't get off lightly either, because Omima grabbed that guard so hard in the crotch that she fell
immediately to the ground. How hard do you have to grab a woman in the crotch that she falls to the ground?
Pretty fucking hard, I think.
It's not like we've got
sensitive stuff on the outside.
My God, it's horrifying.
Yeah, if you get kicked in the fanny though, that does really hurt.
Yeah, I also feel like Americans say fanny, they mean like ass.
Sorry, yeah, I am talking about my genitals.
Yeah, that's what we mean in Britain by fanny, which I never say that word. I feel so weird saying it.
I think I genuinely only say it on this show.
I think you do. I never hear you say it in real life.
Because all we talk about is vaginas. Constantly.
Oh, there's a lot more vagina chat in this in this week's episode. So hold on to your hats. Your vagina hats. Anyway. So Amima, obviously, after this little attack, was convicted of shoplifting and battery and actually went to prison for a few months as well. It all seems to be stemming from, like, rage and quite, like, indiscriminate rage.
Oh, yeah.
She's not like Eileen Wuornos, you know, where she's like, I'm killing men because they are evil. She's just like, whoever fucks with me, I'm going to fucking kill you. It's safe to say that Amima could handle herself.
By October 1991, Amima had bounced her way to Orange County, California, where she met Bill Nelson, another older Texan man with a big personality. And I kind of imagine him like the cowboy from The Simpsons. He wore red cowboy boots, he drove a red Corvette, and he loved big belt buckles. He also claimed to own a cattle ranch, and he had 5 kids and 17 grandchildren. I'm out that door. My opinion aside, Amima thought she had hit the jackpot. There are 2 ways you can look at Amima. Either she's a lost soul in a strange country who just wanted someone to look after her, or she's a gold digger, and you can make up your own minds at the end of the show.
I kind of feel like you can be sort of both of those things. And I kind of think that she is. Anyone who's listened to the show for any amount of time knows that I am massively obsessed with that show, 90 Day Fiancé. There is a lot of this kind of question watching that show. And I think that, in my opinion anyway, that love and relationships, to some people at least, can just be like a commodity. Amima had something that these men, like the rich Texan, wanted. And they had something that she wanted. She has looks and she's like, she's so young. She's like 23 at this point. He's old, but he's rich. And I kind of just feel like as long as those two people are okay with it, then maybe it's fine to be a gold digger.
Yeah, I suppose.
I don't know.
I don't know either.
Probably not what she goes on to do, but up until now.
Wait till the end. Make your mind up.
Yeah.
After meeting Bill in a bar in October 1991, Bill Nelson and Amima appeared to be totally smitten with each other. After just 4 weeks of dating, Bill drove Amima down to Texas and Arkansas to meet his extensive family. That is my worst nightmare. 4 weeks.
Horrifying.
I couldn't do it. But they were fine, apparently, and they stopped off on the way to Texas in Phoenix to get married, just like a roadside wedding. But Amima was not a hit with Bill's family. She was 30 years younger than him, and it didn't go over well at all. After the family visit, the newlyweds drove back up to California just in time for Thanksgiving. Bill spoke to one of his daughters on the phone on Thanksgiving morning, which in 1991 fell on the 28th of November. Bill told his daughter that all was well and they just had loads of food to eat. Amima and Bill spent Thanksgiving just with each other.
Now we have to skip forward to 3 days after Thanksgiving 1991, the day Amima turned up unannounced at her ex-boyfriend Jose's house and was questioned by police. After they finished their initial questions, police officers knew that something didn't add up, so they went out and checked Amima's car. In the front seat of the red Corvette was a black bin bag just sitting there in the California sun. Officers opened the bag and found that it was full of organs. And not church organs, in case you're wondering. We're talking proper fucking entrails. The stuff you see like hanging up in tripe shops in Italy with water running over them in the windows. Innards.
I was so shocked the first time I saw it in Italy. Like they just have these tripe shops. And just like the inside of a cow is just hanging. And you can see it's all like ridged from like where all the nutrients are absorbed in the intestines. And you have to keep it wet in case it dries out. So they just run water over it constantly in the window of the shop.
Why does it need to be on show? Because it's not a particularly nice bit of...
So you know what they sell in there?
Window dressing.
If you're a tourist, you're like, oh, I know, I don't want to go in there.
Oh, I see. I feel like if you're going to kill an animal, eat the whole thing, including the tripe. Does it need to be in the window? Maybe. Can't you just have a sign that says, we sell tripe? But I'm also trying very hard to transition into becoming a vegetarian, so...
You're doing quite well, I think.
Thank you. You've been supportive. You shared that vegetarian sharing board with me the other day.
Yeah, I did. I know that I should be a vegetarian to be friends with the planet, but I struggle with it.
It's hard. Maybe we'll just go look at some tripe shops and it'll put you off.
Maybe that'll put me off.
Yeah. Aversion therapy. Like when you threw your McDonald's all over the floor the other night and text me about it.
Thank you so much for bringing that up. The most embarrassing moment of my life.
Oh, I fell asleep. I woke up and I woke up to that text on my phone.
It was awful. I was coming home from the pub and I was like, oh, well done. Like, you didn't get absolutely smashed. Let's get McDonald's on the way home. So I walked the long way home so I could walk past McDonald's.
I love your pep talks to yourself.
My internal monologue is just a pep talk.
Setting quite a low bar for accomplishments for yourself, to be fair.
I'm very reward driven. So I was like, oh, great. I'll go to McDonald's. Went into McDonald's, ordered so much food that I felt compelled to buy two drinks to make it look like it wasn't all just for my fat self. Get it, take it outside, and immediately trip over my shoelace and throw it into the road. Not even just on the floor, into the road. And there are these two guys there that were trying to help me, and I was so embarrassed that I was just like, please, please, please leave me alone.
Did you just leave it in the road or did you pick it all up?
I think they might have picked it up. But it's a really busy road, like you can't just go and like...
No.
It was like 11:30 on a Saturday night. I couldn't stand in the middle of the road and pick up my cheeseburgers.
No, this is true. This is true. Oh, mate.
It was so embarrassing. And there's this like weird bar opposite the McDonald's and the doorman obviously saw the whole thing and were pissing themselves laughing at me. And I had to walk past them to get home. And they were like, oh, are you all right, love? I was like, yeah, fuck off. I was never here.
Well, think. You didn't eat it in the end.
I didn't eat it, but I did fucking pay for it, didn't I?
No, you did. And those cows did die for it.
Oh, thanks. That makes me feel even worse. I'm sorry, cows.
No, I'm not going to be preachy. I'm sorry. That was a horrible moment for you. Anyway, therapy done. Session closed. Back to this. So the thing is, they open up this bag in Omaima's car and it is, like we said, it's full of fucking organs. Like bloody intestines just sitting there in this bin bag. And inside, when they have a bit of a dig around, they also found a set of lungs. And guess what? These lungs had black carbon deposits on them, which if you were paying attention in GCSE science, is a side effect from smoking cigarettes. Smoking cigarettes is a distinctly human habit. So the police were fairly certain that the bin bag of organs sat in the red Corvette didn't belong to like some unfortunate pig, but did in fact belong to a person. And given the story that Omaima had told Jose Escobar that afternoon, officers were pretty certain that those entrails belonged to one Bill Nelson. Now, a forensics team was sent over to the apartment where Omaima lived with her husband, and they found one big mess. Bill, amongst other things, was a computer programmer, and their house was crammed with computers and computer boxes. And honestly, you can find pictures online of this house, like you actually can't see the floor. It looks like an episode of Hoarders. But other than it looking a bit of a state, to start with, the police didn't find anything suspicious in their sweep of the house.
Omaima was taken down to the police station where she was questioned for 4 hours. And she didn't sit down once. She just paces the room and rambles. And as she's rambling, she referred to herself in the third person loads. She also told police that she often hallucinated about women covered in blood, and that she was descended from ancient Egyptians who could talk to her and act through her. And some people make quite a big deal out of this, thinking, oh, it's so ridiculous she thinks she's descended from ancient Egyptians. She is actually Egyptian. Like, I don't think that's that weird for her to be like, I am descended from it. Like, she probably is.
I don't know why people pick up on that as being weird. I mean, maybe she, I don't know, does she say anything specific about, like, being descended from, like, Cleopatra or Ramses? Like, because then that's a bit like, yeah, everyone is always... either a reincarnation of Cleopatra or descended from her.
Yeah, it's never like I worked in the mines.
Yeah, it's never like I was just one of those many peasants who died of the plague.
Which, statistically speaking, you're much more likely to be one of those than you are to be Cleopatra.
To be like reincarnation of Cleopatra or a reincarnation of Anastasia. It's like, probably not, but okay.
Well, we don't know if Anastasia's dead, so...
Oh, she's dead.
I killed her.
I didn't mean it to sound so sinister. She's definitely dead.
So we're not saying that she was actually communicating with Ramses III, but it does seem like there are slightly more important things in this case to take issue with. The organs in the car being one of them. She blamed these organs on Bill Nelson. She told the police that she thought Bill had killed someone. She did not explain why she was driving that bag of insides around in the car.
That is quite hard to explain, though.
Yeah, if you hate your husband so much, he beats you, he rapes you, and he kills someone, why are you disposing of the body for him?
Yeah.
But the point Amaima was trying to make was that her husband, Bill Nelson, was no angel. And she was right. Bill had served 4 years on the inside for drug trafficking. Bill was a pilot, and he got caught with a plane full of marijuana in Mexico. Go big or go home, I think, with drug smuggling. Just, if you're going to do it.
Really? That's your fucking advice for drug smugglers. Go big or go home.
Go big or go to prison.
No, it's go big and definitely go to prison.
Go big and go to prison.
Go small and maybe you'll get off with just personal use. But go big
and
go to jail.
Yeah. Go big, get away with it, then go home. That's my advice.
That's an important caveat to remember when you're talking about this.
And according to Amaima, this drugs charge was the least of Bill Nelson's sins. She told officers that he was violent, that he would tie her up and rape her. And sometimes these sadistic sessions would go on for days at a time.
But the police, still at this point, weren't sure what to think of Amaima. She was telling a sad story, but she still had a bag of organs in her car. So police pressed Amaima for details of what had happened on Thanksgiving. She told them that Bill had tied her up, raped her, and sat on her chest so she couldn't breathe. But when asked how Amaima managed to escape being tied up and what had happened to Bill, Amaima said, "I don't believe he's dead. He can't be." And I don't know, I think early on, like very early on with her saying these kind of things and all of the rambling, the talking in third person, she does start to seem very much like her thoughts aren't particularly organised.
Yeah, I agree.
So back at Amaima and Bill's apartment, Frank Riddersill and the other police officers spotted some blood on the doorknob and even more on the carpet. Detective Robert Phillips later described that Costa Mesa apartment to be the most gruesome crime scene he had ever encountered. Because the police spotted some more bin bags, just like the one they found in the red car. Some were just lying around and some were inside suitcases, but all of them were totally saturated with fluids and flesh. Inside the soggy flesh bags were more body parts, a broken lamp, an iron, and that isn't even the worst of it. In the kitchen, the police found a deep fat fryer, and inside it, they found a pair of severed hands floating in the oil.
You can just imagine it, can't you? Just like the fingertips poking up over the... I've been thinking about this a lot.
And if that wasn't bad enough, what was later discovered to be meat from a human hip was found to be put with leftover Thanksgiving turkey meat in the fridge, in what seems to have been an attempt to disguise it. I find this crime scene very confusing because it's like some of it's just like, oh, we'll chop the body up, we'll leave it in these bin bags, there's blood everywhere, there's bits of organs, there's like severed hands in the a deep fat fryer. This bit of hip meat, let's stick it on the turkey and leave it in the fridge. We've got to hide that.
Trying to hide it all in lots of different places. I don't know, it's bizarre.
But not very well. It's almost like when you read about all this, it's like she started to like, you know, hide his body and dispose of his body. And then she was like, oh, this is just too much. I'm in over my head. There is just no way I can get rid of this body.
She gives up.
Yeah, she gives
up. That's what it sounds like.
And I think she probably has a bit of a sense of relief when the police find her. She's like, oh, great. I might be going to jail, but I do not have to clean this up anymore.
I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Forget the pressure to overhaul your life. The new year doesn't need a new you. It needs you. Grounded, supported, and ready to grow. Grow Therapy helps you make meaningful change at your pace and on your time. Whether it's your first time in therapy or your 50th, Grow makes it easier to find a therapist who fits you, not the other way around. They connect you with thousands of independent, licensed therapists across the U.S., offering both virtual and in-person sessions, nights, and weekends. You can search by what matters, like insurance, specialty, identity, or availability, to get started in as little as 2 days. And if something comes up, you can cancel up to 24 hours in advance at no cost. There are no subscriptions and no long-term commitments. You just pay per session. Grow helps you find therapy on your time. Whatever challenges you're facing, Grow Therapy is here to help. Grow accepts over 100 insurance plans, including Medicaid, in some states. Sessions average about $21 with insurance, and some pay as little as $0, depending on their plan. Visit growtherapy.com/get started today to get started. That's growtherapy.com/get started. growtherapy.com/get started. Availability and coverage vary by state and insurance plan.
You may remember deep in your mind cave, we once told you about a podcast, wasn't once, it was last year, called Wisecrack, from our good old buddy old pals over at Tenderfoot. Wisecrack is a really unique blend of stand-up comedy set and a shocking true crime case. Basically, a comedian describes the night he found himself at the centre of a double murder. Wisecrack has gone on to make Apple's best podcasts list, and that's full of people like us, so you know it's true. And it's nominated for iHeart and Ambie Awards this year. And it was The Guardian's podcast of the year, top tier, number one, top spot. And now Wisecrack is heading on a true crime slash comedy tour with comedian Ed Hedges performing his stand-up set live. And it's in a city that is maybe, very possibly, near you. Wisecrack's tour will hit Dublin and Manchester, as well as London on Valentine's Day, and then it will head into the US for February and March. For dates and ticket info, visit wisecracklive.com. That's wisecracklive.com, and search Wisecrack in your podcast app to listen to the show and see what all the noise and hype is about, my friend.
There's even more horror waiting for these poor investigators, because in the freezer, next to just some carrots and hot dogs and peas, there was a human head. And this head, like the hands, had also been given the deep fat fryer treatment. And it was so severely burned that although it may not have looked like Bill Nelson after it had been deep fried, the police were pretty sure that they were dealing with the dismembered bits of Bill the Texan pilot and drug smuggler.
When police moved into the bedroom, they saw that the bedposts had been broken. And this fitted in with Amima's story. Remember, she had told police that Bill had tied her to the bed and raped her. So the police, giving her the benefit of the doubt to a certain extent, I think, started to concoct a theory. Perhaps Amima was tied to the bed, raped by her husband, and then broke free to hit him in the head with the now broken lamp and the iron found in the bin bags. This theory quickly fell by the wayside as they took the sheets off the bed and found the mattress to be soaked with blood. And Amima's story started to look even less likely when a pair of legs were discovered in one of the bin bags. And the ankles of those legs had rings of reddish-black bruises around their ankles, consistent with someone who had been tied up. So maybe it wasn't Amima that had been tied to the bed after all. With her story falling apart around her, Amima was taken to the nearest hospital for a sexual assault examination and for the injuries on her arms and breasts to be dealt with. And that report found no evidence of sexual assault. But I think what they mean by that is they found no vaginal or anal tearing to be present. And this is 1991. Even today, a rape kit needs to be taken no more than 72 hours after the assault has occurred, and the results can be offset by taking a shower or brushing your hair. So I'm not sure we can conclusively say that she wasn't raped by Bill Nelson based on that testing. I just don't know. I just didn't find enough, because it's so long after the event, if it happened, like, I just don't think that assessment can have been particularly reliable.
Yeah.
They just didn't find any evidence of her being raped with the resources that they had at the time.
Now, Amima's examination did reveal something, though. It revealed that none of the injuries on her hands and breasts were determined to be defensive wounds. They were more consistent, it seemed, with the wounds that someone may sustain when dismembering a human body. Which is a very specific activity to be able to attribute wounds to.
I watched an interview with one of the police officers as he talks about it, and I don't think it's like they had a tick list of, like, if you have a dismembered a human body, you will have these injuries.
I think what he means is like she'd very clearly undertaken a large physical task that had gone on for a long time. And yeah. I'm pretty sure that you can say that dismembering a human body is that.
Is that, absolutely. I mean, it's a marathon, it's not a sprint. And also, Amaima is petite. She's a small lady.
Oh, yeah.
And Bill Nelson is not petite. He's a big guy. It probably looked like maybe she'd be, it was a bit worse for wear after having tried to hack up a giant man in her house over the course of 3 days.
No, I think that's a fair assessment. Guess.
Even if you can't attribute it to like a specific thing, it's like you said, she's undergone clearly a very strenuous activity. But I think it is probably quite easy to determine whether wounds are or are not defensive wounds.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think they're quite obvious sometimes.
Yeah, that's the key thing, is that they're not defensive. They're from something else.
So after the hospital, Amaima was taken back to the police station, where to everyone's amazement, she quietly said, "I have a confession now." And have a confession she did. Amaima told the investigators that she had killed Bill Nelson. She had killed and attacked him. And she had no other choice than to do so to save her own life. Amaima claimed to remember nothing after hitting Bill with the lamp. The next thing she said she remembered was waking up and finding Bill's body in bits, in bin bags all around her. She claimed to have heard voices saying, quote, "Something inside me told me I had to do it, like demons." Amaima then asked to see a psychiatrist and was placed under arrest on suspicion of the murder of her husband and transferred to jail, where her bail was set at $250,000.
Meanwhile, all the bits of body had been collected by the forensics team, and the medical examiner confirmed that all of the parts were from the same person, and that person was, as suspected, Bill Nelson. The head in the freezer had sustained 25 or more blows to the skull, and what was even more concerning to the coroner was how well Bill's body had been dismembered. Almost too well for a first time.
I think that's also quite an interesting bit of the story, because like to chop up an entire body and for a coroner to say it was done, quote, well, it's quite not like a everyday bit of knowledge to know how to disjoint and like dismember a human.
No, I don't think I'd know where to start. I think I could get through the flesh, but once I got to the bones, I'd be in trouble, I think.
Yeah, even knowing where to cut. I mean, having the like fortitude to be able to do it, but also knowing exactly where to cut. That somebody would be like, it was well done. And I think also maybe he means it's well done that it was, she'd just gone for it, you know?
And he was in like segments, he hadn't just been hacked to
Jesus.
Pieces.
That's quite an achievement for somebody who, you know, claiming this is their first time ever having done it.
Yeah, and he's, as we said, a big guy. When he was alive, Bill Nelson was 230 pounds. So that's 16 stone four, or for our European friends, 104 kilos. His dismembered parts were arranged and it was discovered that 85 pounds, so that's 6 stone or 38.5 kilos of Bill Nelson, were missing, including his genitals. And you've got to remember, this was the early 90s. Jeffrey Dahmer had been arrested in the summer of 91. Cannibalism was at the forefront of everyone's minds. So it's not surprising that when they couldn't find all of Bill, investigators questioned whether Amaima had eaten bits of him. She had deep fried him, after all. So could the hands in the fryer be an attempt to destroy his fingerprints? Or was she just saving them for later?
It's a really weird part of the case that she deep fries the head and deep fries the hands and then still keeps them. I can understand why, when there's that much missing, like over 30 kilos of his body, including his genitals, are missing. They walk into a kitchen where there's fucking hip meat mixed in with the turkey meat and like a head that's been deep fried, hands in a deep fat fryer. Like, yeah, I think it's natural that they jump to the conclusion that she's been eating him.
Oh, for sure. And what's even weirder than that, interviews with the Nelsons' neighbours revealed that since Thanksgiving, they heard the garbage disposal unit in the Nelsons' apartment going almost non-stop for 2 days until it broke. Garbage disposals are so loud, I would be so annoyed. If I heard it going for 2 days, I would call the police, just because of my own annoyance, not because I think anything's going wrong. You've got to be doing something untoward if you're running your garbage disposal for 2 days.
Getting rid of 30 kilos of a man you murdered is what's happened here. So Amaima was given the psychiatrist that she asked for in the form of Dr. David Scheffner. And during their first assessment session, Amaima embellished her confession in a pretty terrifying way. And I think that this bit of the story that she like embellishes and adds on to her original confession, if it's true, fucking hell. If it's not, why does she say it? because she told Dr. Scheffner that after she had hit Bill with the lamp, it had broken, so she kept hitting him with the electric iron. Then she stabbed Bill in the neck with a pair of scissors, and then she went about the dismemberment of her husband, which must have taken days. And like we said, that year, Thanksgiving was on the 28th of November, and she didn't show up with the bag of insides at Jose's house for another 3 days after that. So yeah, it feels like during those 3 days between Thanksgiving and the day she turns up at Jose's house, she's desperately trying to get rid of him down the garbage disposal. Now, this is the bit of embellishment that Amima adds, because she continued, after she'd murdered Bill, she put on a red dress with matching shoes and lipstick, and then she had cooked her husband's ribs with barbecue sauce and eaten them. And she added, quite unnecessarily, I think, really, don't say this if you're ever under suspicion of murder. She added that nothing tasted as sweet as her husband.
So dramatic, isn't it?
It is. The red dress, the red shoes, the red lipstick, cooking up some
ribs.
Yeah,
it's all been shot in black and white, but only her lips are red.
Oh, God. And it's just like her, like, wiggling around a kitchen, cooking up some ribs, but it's actually her husband's ribs.
Let's make a short film.
Oh, and she sat at the table, like, licking barbecue sauce off her fingers. Yeah. Oh, gross. So, after hearing this, Scheffner stated that he had never dealt with a case so bizarre and diagnosed Mrs. Nelson as psychotic.
Forensic psychologist Dr. Nancy Kayser-Boyd has a slightly softer analysis. Kayser-Boyd found Amima to be soft-spoken and childlike, but definitely deeply disturbed. According to Kayser-Boyd, Bill Nelson would degrade Amima constantly, rape her, and he threatened to bury her in the desert during their road trip. This abuse from Bill was the final straw when it was placed on top of a lifetime of abuse.
And the thing is, though, the abuse from Bill, we don't definitely know whether this happened, do we? Like, there's no corroborators for this. She says it, and Dr. Kayser-Boyd is like, yes, I believe her, that she was abused by this man. But there's no one who can corroborate this and say that Bill was abusive to Amima. We just don't know.
And this is another thing that we get from Nancy Kayser-Boyd that maybe we can't 100% confirm. But according to Nancy Kayser-Boyd, Amima had been subjected to female genital mutilation in Egypt, where it's referred to as initiation or female circumcision, and it's still common practice. FGM is far too important an issue for us to just skip over. It's the practice of forcibly removing parts of the female genitalia, and the age this happens to girls varies. Sometimes they're babies or toddlers, and sometimes they're almost in their teens, or they could be any age in between. Girls who are subjected to FGM are usually taken by female family members to someone who will cut them, or the female family members will cut their own children.
And when I used to work with, you know, child protection groups to produce events for, you know, safeguarding professionals to hear about stuff like this, like I said, this was hugely on the rise, especially in places like London and Birmingham and Manchester, and more people wanted to hear about what this was. And I sat through hours and hours and hours and hours of workshops and lectures of professionals talking about this. I've seen lots of pictures. It is horrific. And we're not skirting around what we're actually talking about with FGM. There are four types of FGM. There's type one, and this is known as a clitorindectomy. It's partial or total removal of the clitoris and or its hood. Type two is called excision. The clitoris and labia minora are partially or totally removed. This can include excision of the labia majora as well. Type three is the most severe. It is known as infibulation. And this procedure consists of narrowing the vaginal orifice with a creation of a covering seal by cutting the labia minora and or the labia majora with or without removal of the clitoris. The joining of the wound edges consists of stitching or holding the cut areas together for a certain period of time. Essentially, to cut the wounds, push them together and allow your body to heal, essentially closing up the vagina. And in some cases, girls' legs are bound together to create a covering seal, and a small opening, sometimes as small as the size of a matchstick, is all that's left for urine and menstrual blood to escape. And the seal can be opened either through penetrative sexual intercourse or surgery. And yeah, women who go through this, like so many of them, the pain, infections, like so many girls die after having things like this done. And even if they imagine the pain of then when they are older, getting married and then having sexual intercourse, like basically tearing open that wound. And some of them, you know, when they do get pregnant, go on to have children, the complications that arise during childbirth. Like, this is a horrific practice. And then you finally have something called type 4. And this type covers essentially all other procedures to the genitalia of women for non-medical purposes. So it could be like a piercing or scraping or cauterization or, I don't know, I actually watched like a documentary, maybe like Channel 4 or something, about like designer vaginas.
Oh yeah, the perfect vagina. I think I've seen the exact same one.
Oh my God. I was like, what the fuck are you doing? Stop it, for God's sake.
So technically, if you get a labiaplasty, that is type 4 FGM. FGM has been illegal in the UK since 1986, and it's just this year been made illegal by federal law in the United States, but it still happens. The arguments used by its supporters are not dissimilar to the arguments used by people who support male circumcision. What they'll say is it's cultural, it's clean, and it's aesthetically more acceptable. But please be aware that I'm not saying FGM is the same as male circumcision. It's not. The massive difference is that female circumcision is an attempt to suppress female sexual desire, and in some cases, it makes sex too painful to enjoy at all. So it's a device of oppression. That's what we're talking
Absolutely.
About.
Absolutely. It's very much so that if you've had FGM done on you, you're much less likely to cheat or to engage in premarital sex or extramarital sex because it's so horrific you wouldn't possibly enjoy it. That's what it's there for, right? Rather than chaining you to the floor, we'll cut your clitoris off so that you don't ever want to have sex with anyone else anyway.
And we're not going to tell you what to think, but if you want to start asking yourself some pretty serious questions about what we're talking about, I'd advise you to watch American Circumcision. It's a documentary on Netflix, and you can also go to dofeve.com, which is run by the Daughters of Eve, who are a non-profit, who can tell you all you need to know about FGM and how people are working to stop it. But if you do watch that documentary, you will come across Fumbai Amadu, who argues that the term female genital mutilation is, quote, offensive, divisive, demeaning, inflammatory, and absolutely unnecessary. So she argues that her circumcision that she underwent in Sierra Leone, age 22, didn't affect her negatively at all. She actually says it improved her sex life, and in her culture that it's celebrated. So she has quite a unique position in that she's Sierra Leone American. She was at college in America when she was asked by her mother to go to Sierra Leone with her younger sister, who was 8 years old, to go through this initiation process, is what she called it. And so she's quite unique in that she was sexually active before and after the procedure, which is obviously very, very rare. But I can't with her. Like, oh, when talking about type 3, the most severe, in interviews, people will bring that up and she's like, oh, but that's only 10%. Still hundreds of thousands of women, only 10%.
And even the type 1, I'm sorry, why? Well, we know why. We just talked about why.
Well, that's the other thing she says. There was like, a surgeon in America went to prison for performing type 1 on girls, and she went on some TV program to talk about it, and she said like, oh, but like type 1, it was type 1A, that's just a nick, it's barely anything. And I'm like, well, why are they doing it then if it's so inconsequential?
You have your culture, you have your beliefs, whatever, but I think the minute they start to infringe on people's choice, because she talks a lot about choice, but majority of women and girls that go through this don't have a choice. They don't have a choice about it.
And you can't, when it comes to something that's abusive,
you can't consent to choice. Yeah, you can't actively, with all of the knowledge, make up your mind. When it's something like this, no one is offering you, this is option A, this is option B, this is option C. You can choose. It's either you can do it and be part of this family and this community and it's culturally correct, or you cannot do it and we'll either make you do it or you'll be shunned. That's not a choice, in my opinion. And also, your culture and your beliefs and all of that aside, the minute they start to infringe on people's freedoms and welfare and well-being, psychologically, emotionally, sexually, physically, it is moot point, and it's absolutely, it doesn't win. You don't get to win. You don't just get to say, this is my culture, therefore it's right. No, otherwise we would still be doing all sorts of barbaric things. The reason that this is pertinent to the case that we're talking about today is that according to Nancy Kayser Boyd, Amima Nelson had undergone the most severe form of FGM, type 3. So that meant for her, sex was very painful and that she probably wouldn't have enjoyed it at all. The other thing that Dr. Nancy Kayser Boyd discovered during her time with Amima was that according to Egyptian folklore, a person who is not in one piece cannot go into the afterlife. So according to Nancy Kayser Boyd, Amima had dismembered Bill Nelson so that she wouldn't have to run into him on the other side when she eventually died. So I guess what she's doing here is saying, yeah, the abuse that she suffered as a child, the FGM, most horrific form, the sexual abuse. Then Bill Nelson piles his abuse on top of that. She snaps and she kills him. And then on top of that, well, why does she dismember him then? She dismembers him because of her beliefs, because of this folklore. She's doing it so she never has to run into Bill Nelson in the afterlife. So I guess if you believe that, it does make sense. If you believe that Amima believed that. And I guess it's like, what, how you shouldn't be cremated if you're a Catholic, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like if you're, maybe the Pope's changed his mind on this now, but certainly when I was growing up, if your body is not in one piece, if you are cremated, you can't, because the whole idea is that your body is waiting for you in heaven. So if it's burnt, it's not going
to
be there.
Now let's get to the trial of Amima Nelson. A year and a day after police found Bill Nelson's head in his own freezer, the trial of Amima Nelson began, and she was charged with murder in the first degree. And the prosecution thought that they pretty much had a slam dunk. Defense attorney Thomas Mooney put up one hell of a fight. He painted Amima as a tortured soul, who after sustaining a lifetime of abuse and a violent sexual relationship with Bill Nelson, had pushed her to murder in self-defense. He and Dr. Nancy Kayser Boyd argued that Amima had PTSD, and to cope with her trauma, she retreated into a fantasy world where her ancient ancestors ruled and told her what to do. And this psychosis triggered the episode in which she had murdered and dismembered her husband. In court, Amima denied eating any part of Bill Nelson, despite having confessed to it to Dr. Scheffner the year before. And this is the thing, what she said to Dr. Scheffner was so specific. It's that red dress, the red lips, the red shoes, the ribs. It's also specific and so brazen and depraved. You do have to wonder, I don't know, did she eat him? Or back then, when she said it and asked for a psychiatrist, was she just trying to like plan for an insanity, a plea?
I'm really not sure. I also think she could have still been in some sort of psychotic state when she's in that interview and just saying things that aren't true and never happened. Or maybe she did it, or maybe she was cognizant enough to be like, I need to go for an insanity plea. But insanity pleas are like so difficult to prove anyway. And the whole point of the case is that she's tried to get rid of the bodies, which shows that she knows that what she was doing was wrong. So there's no way she's getting an insanity plea out of this.
This is the thing. But then she almost stops, though, trying to get the insanity plea when it comes to trial, because she's saying, I didn't eat him then. She said all that stuff to Scheffner like a year ago. Maybe she was trying to put together an insanity plea back then. But again, this woman, she's so young. She's living in this foreign country. She's killed this guy. I don't know. Can we say that she's with it enough to know, oh, I better act crazy so they don't put me in prison and send me to a psychiatric hospital instead? How aware would she have even been that she might have needed to build an insanity plea?
The prosecution team led by Orange County Deputy District Attorney Randy Pawlowski's case throws the idea of Amima being an abused woman with no nefarious motives onto very shaky ground, with their star witness, Robert Hansen, who, like Bill Nelson, was in his 50s and had been in a romantic relationship with Amima in 1990. Hansen told the court that he and the defendant had lived together until one evening, when Amima told him that she wanted to tie him up, and thinking that this was some sort of sexy game, Hansen agreed. But once he was tied up and defenseless, Amima pulled a gun on him and told him that she would kill him unless he gave her more money. Luckily for him, Robert Hansen managed to struggle free of his bonds, overpower Amima, and kick her out of his house, but he was too embarrassed to go to the police. So that testimony tells a very different story of Amima Nelson, not a defenseless victim of abuse, but someone who entered into relationships with older men to take their money and threatened them when they didn't pay up. So which one is it? Or does it even really have to be one or the other? I'm not sure it does.
I don't know. I think there's so many things that could go either way, because you could say she chops up the body. Oh, is it because of her beliefs, like Dr. Nancy Kayser Boyd says? I don't know. Even then, she's lucid enough at that point to be like, I need to get rid of the body. But you could say she comes out of her psychotic spell and then she's like, fuck, I better get rid of this body. I don't know. But I think the thing to me is that Robert Hansen, this guy, says she tied me up and threatened me. Remember, the legs they found at the apartment looked like they had ligature marks on. She tied up Bill Nelson.
She's got form, for sure. And I do also think that, like, having been a victim of abuse doesn't necessarily mean you never do anything wrong again in your life, you know?
No, absolutely not.
The question the jury had to answer was one of premeditation. There was no question that Amima had killed her husband, and there was no question that she had dismembered him and attempted to dispose of his body down the garbage disposal and by driving around with a bag of intestines in a red Corvette. But had she planned the murder? And the planning is what separates first and second degree murder. First degree murder is any intentional murder that is willful and premeditated. Second degree murder is any intentional murder with malice aforethought, but that is not premeditated or planned in advance. And when I first started reading about this, I did think it was this sort of the red mist descends and she didn't plan it. She didn't think about hurting him before that particular incident. But the more I think about Robert Hansen, I think maybe she did plan it. Maybe it went too far. Maybe she didn't mean it to go as far as it did. But if Robert Hansen hadn't have got three, I think she probably would have shot him.
I think so. I think it's a really important distinction to make between first degree murder and second degree murder, because it isn't the second degree murder isn't that you've not thought about it at all and it's just like a crime of passion. That would be more like manslaughter, where it's happened and you've actually had no malice aforethought or premeditation like you would with first degree or second degree murder. And I think in this case, it would be more to me that it seems more like second degree murder, where it's like she's thought about this. There's been malice forethought, but it's not been premeditated or planned because she doesn't have an idea for how to get rid of the body.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And the thing is, eventually after 17 days of deliberation, the jury agreed because they convicted Amaima Nelson of the murder of Bill Nelson in the second degree on the 12th of January 1993. She was also found guilty of the assault of Robert Hansen. Amaima was sentenced to 27 years in prison. And there are some that argue, Dr. Nancy Kaser Boyd included, that prison was the wrong place for Amaima, and that she should have been sent to a psychiatric hospital instead. Amaima has never shown any remorse for her crimes, and none of her appeals have been granted. Parole hearings rolled around in 2006 and in 2011, but both times Amaima was ruled to be a serious threat to public safety. And also, she's never shown any remorse, like, just pretend at least, because you're never going to get parole unless you show remorse for what you've done. And in the 2011 hearing, Amaima represented herself, and she insisted, still, that she had acted in self-defense. She said, "My life was in danger. If I didn't defend my life, I would have been dead. I'm sorry it happened, but I'm glad I lived. I'm sorry I dismembered his body. I crossed the reality line. I saw the blood and I freaked out. I'm not here to justify what I did. I was temporarily insane."
Randy Pawlowski made an appearance at this hearing too, 12 years after he had prosecuted Nelson in 1993. And he made the same arguments that he did then, citing Amaima's history of violence and noting that she'd never shown any remorse. During the hearing, Amaima added, quote, "I swear to God, I did not eat any part of him. I'm not a monster." To which Commissioner Cynthia Fritz asked, "What was your purpose in cooking him?" An excellent point that Nelson declined to answer. So Amaima hadn't taken part in any prison rehabilitation programs or skill workshops, but she did claim to be a born-again Christian, and she had remarried while she was in prison. Her new husband was in his 70s and he actually died before the hearing, but that didn't stop Amaima using him in her defence. She claimed her marriage to this 70-year-old man to be evidence that she was no longer a threat to society because the couple enjoyed three-day-long conjugal visits in accommodation, which included dangerous implements, and at no point did she kill him.
Why are they allowed to have three-day-long conjugal visits which included dangerous implements, is my question.
That's what I want to know. She also claimed that her new husband was never afraid that she would stab him to death during these rendezvous, but he's not exactly around to confirm whether that's true, is he? But it seems, I thought three-day-long conjugal visits sounded like a really long time, but apparently, in the states where conjugal visits are allowed, which is New York, Washington, Connecticut, and California, they can last up to 3 days, and they can happen as often as once a month. Isn't
that
nuts?
I was really shocked when we read that, but then I do also think that as much as there will be people being like, oh my God, I can't believe like they get PlayStation 3s and they can have 3 day long conjugal visits and all this. But like, if you're saying that prison is there to rehabilitate people, allowing them to still maintain those relationships with people on the outside is the best way to try and to minimize the risk of reoffending. I believe that. So yeah, I guess I'm more shocked that it's like people go and have 3 day conjugal visits and can actually get it on in like a prison caravan.
I'd be all right, I think. If it'd been 3 weeks, I think I'd be fine.
Oh, good. Good for you.
Hi, Mum. So Amaima Nelson won't be getting any more conjugal visits because her husband's dead, and she won't be getting another parole hearing until 2026. She'll serve the rest of her sentence in Cowchilla's Central California Women's Facility and will probably never know if she ate Bill's ribs or not.
That is the big unanswered question with this case, and it will forever remain. But that is the story of Amaima Nelson.
Thank you for joining us.
And as ever, you can come and follow us on Instagram, on Facebook, on Twitter, all that at Red Handed the Pod. You can also, if you would like to, help support the show at patreon.com/redhanded And here are some lovely people who have done that this week. We have, it's a big list. Abby Brown, Autumn B, Lauren Shear, Lizette Shields, Sherrad Ravel, Samuel Tony Brown, Rona Gray, Chloe Kimmel, Joe Wagner, Candice Williams, Isabella, Teresa Bruner, Rachel Thornton, Alexandra Berrigon, Berrigon, Miriam, Samantha Boyd, Bethany, Georgia Vulgaris, Paige Bullock, Bethany Ingalls, Claire Morrison, Bailey Rakestraw, Joyce Lovelace, Joni Maloney. Great name.
Never change your name, Janie Maloney.
Kat, Phil, Sarah, Sarah, Edwards, Morgan Black, Sasha Canning, Emily Yao, Hannah Mabry, Ruby Fletcher, Lane Price, Zoe, Erin, Alice Rose, and Jenny Perez. Thank you guys so much. You are the best.
Thank you. And if you're new to the show, take 5 seconds to leave us a 5-star review. If you don't like the show, mind your business.
Exactly.
And we'll see you next week.
We'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye.
¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Yeah. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. Yeah. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
You may remember deep in your mind cave, we once told you about a podcast, wasn't once, it was last year, called Wisecrack, from our good old buddy old pals over at Tenderfoot. Wisecrack is a really unique blend of stand-up comedy set and a shocking true crime case. Basically, a comedian describes the night he found himself at the centre of a double murder. Wisecrack has gone on to make Apple's best podcasts list, and that's full of people like us, so you know it's true. And it's nominated for iHeart and Ambi Awards this year. And it was The Guardian's podcast of the year, top tier, number one, top spot. And now Wisecrack is heading on a true crime slash comedy tour with comedian Ed Hedges performing his stand-up set live. And it's in a city that is maybe, very possibly, near you. Wisecrack's tour will hit Dublin and Manchester, as well as London on Valentine's Day, and then it will head into the US for February and March. For dates and ticket info, visit wisecracklive.com. That's wisecracklive.com, and search Wisecrack in your podcast app to listen to the show and see what all the noise and hype is about, my friend.